Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, the host. And today we're going to be speaking to Rick Sterling. He has an excellent article in Covert Action Magazine. And it was published July 12, but you find it at Covert Action Mag. And the title is Weaponizing Humanitarian Aid to Syria, Deceitful Cover for U.S. Support of Al-Qaeda and an Excuse to Violate Syrian Sovereignty and the U.N. Charter. Rick Sterling, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you, Phil.
You're bitten off quite an important matter here. The humanitarian aid is such a lovely thing to say and to allegedly believe in. As I read your article, it boils down to the Turkish-Syrian border and a checkpoint, I guess you'd call it, and where, in the name of humanitarian aid, materials are going into Syria, into an area of Idlib, controlled, according to your article, by Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. Tell us, well, how you know that and what's the game here? How long has this been going on?
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been going on for about 7 years. And this is the last official crossing point where United Nations approved transport vehicles can take massive amounts of supplies. There are some food and other supplies, and people suspect that there's also weapons. Years ago, Serena Shim documented World Food Program trucks carrying weapons into that same area, as well as jihadis. And she was she died in very suspicious circumstances. After she was given word that Turkish intelligence was looking for her. But in any case, Idlib province is bordering Turkey. And that is the region where militants and their militants' families who left Aleppo and left Duma and left other cities under agreements with the Syrian government where they would relinquish control, the Syrian government would regain administration. Most of the civilians stayed, but some civilians left with the militants. And so they're now grouped in Idlib province. Additionally, there are militants who invaded that area in 2014 in massive quantities, a lot of foreign fighters, including Uyghurs. There was a contingent of Uyghurs who spearheaded the operation, according to some of the militants themselves.
Yeah.
But the area is...
Can I ask you there, by the way, just one question about that?
Yeah.
The Uyghurs then would have passed through Turkey.
Yes, yes.
And my understanding, I've heard this story too. I think it's very important because for some reason, Western media doesn't want to remind us that they exist, but they're fairly numerous.
Yes.
Rather notorious for their methods of warfare.
Right.
So they brought their families. Is that right?
That is right. And this was coordinated with the Turkish government. They were given Turkish visas to travel to Turkey. Some of them stayed in Turkey, and a lot of them, they were told that you have to go into Syria if you're departing China. So it was facilitated by the Turkish intelligence. And there are, I don't know whether there's thousands or tens of thousands, but there's significant numbers.
Yeah. Now, we read about Idlib in New York Times, Toronto Star, and whatnot. Most reporting is trying to turn it into some sort of idyllic democratic community, just full of free spirits. But your identification would be somewhat different. They are actually terrorists. They have labels and they control the streets, etc. Mm-hmm. Who are they? I mean, mm-hmm. undoubtedly, I mean, by the way, there's also the Chameleon phenomenon. I notice it's writers like yourself have to suffer through this. They change their names a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so exactly. One day they're this, the next day they're that, but they are always with guns and they're running the place.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So they began as Jabhat al-Nusra, and it was the official branch of al-Qaeda. They split with what became ISIS, but Jabhat al-Nusra was the formally allied franchise of al-Qaeda, then later on they changed their name to Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. But they have got the same leadership and they've got the same principles. Right now, there's an interesting phenomenon going on where the U.S. is trying to take them off of the designated terrorist list.
Really?
At the United Nations Security Council, Russia has pushed that there be a recognized authoritative terrorist list, and that that there are restrictions posed on that. Now, there's an active campaign in the U.S. that began a year and a half ago, whereby the leader of HTS or Nusra, we can just call them the al-Qaeda in Syria, Jalani's his name, they're trying to normalize him. He was featured on a frontline program recently, being interviewed by Martin Smith. And the US would evidently like to open the doors so that they can more openly supply weapons to them.
Mm-hmm. And with that, there must be some kind of a hitch, right? And a problem, because the US, or I should say the West, there have been negotiations where there are Syrian opposition people who actually do speak to the government. Mm-hmm. But those are people who've agreed not to engage in further hostilities, is my understanding. So the mm-hmm. game would be to try to get the ones who are still in hostilities to somehow slip into the process. Is that right?
Well, that's right. And one thing that's not known by everybody is that there's an opposition within Syria. You've got, of course, the Ba'ath Party, which was a one-party state up until 2012, where they changed their constitution. But when I went there in 2013, for the first time, we met six or seven leaders of different opposition groups. It was 2014. Because it was just before the election which was held in April of 2014. But we met six or seven quite very impressive leaders, including women. So it's not known that generally in the West that there are registered political opposition parties of different persuasions. Yeah. Within Syria. Now, outside of Syria, there are, of course, there's the U.S.-backed Syrian National Council. There's groups usually led by people who left Syria decades ago. So how much they know about Syria and what their roots are in Syria is really questionable. But Syria, there is a... there's an active opposition within Syria that's limited because they do recognize they're still in a state of war. That's a factor, but there's definitely forces that want to push the country further away from being a one-party state.
Yeah, we're speaking to Rick Sterling in the article, it was published July 12th. Covert Action, a wonderful magazine, by the way.
Yes.
Rick Sterling has written about this subject.
Phil, if I can put in a little plug for Covert Action magazine. Of course, I became aware of it maybe about less than a year ago. I became aware that they're doing very nice work. I knew of them from 20 years ago, but I don't know what their history has been, and but they've definitely been revived. They're doing very good. And of course, the head editor is Philip Agee's son, Chris Agee. So that's another reason to check it out. And I think people who do check it out will find it very interesting.
You know, I'm really glad you speak of Covert Action magazine, and particularly it's tracing it back to Philip Agee. And if people want to get a framework to understand American imperialism, yeah, Covert Action be the place to go in the life of Philip Agee.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
People today talk about Assange, Julian Assange and others, but Philip Agee probably had the best grasp and helped us, walked us through, as it were, what was actually going on with American intelligence. Mm-hmm. And it's Rick Sterling. I want to bring this matter. Unfortunately, the humanitarian aid is functioning there because the Security Council agreed to it. Your article indicates that Russia and China are starting to get restless with this, and because it is a fact, as you refer, that the political leadership of Idlib are people who are identified on the UN records as terrorists. Mm-hmm. So, you know, something obviously needs to be done, mm-hmm, and what is being done to see to it that the aid doesn't just become a Turkish intelligence supplying the Al-Qaeda.
Right. Well, when I first started thinking about the article, it looked as though Russia and perhaps China as well, they were going to veto the extension of that border crossing. And there was a lot of stories in the Western press, and a lot of statements by organizations such as the International Rescue Committee, saying how dire this would be and how basically the sky would fall if Bab al-Hawa crossing was stopped, if that transition point between Turkey and Syria was stopped. And so when I wrote it, I was mostly thinking about the uproar that would happen. And what ended up happening was there was discussions between the Russian President Putin and US President Biden. And among one of their discussion points was Syria. And I think probably that influenced, that it might have influenced things where Russia determined they don't really want to lock horns on this issue with the US right now. So what they agreed to was an extension of the border crossing for 6 months, and that before that, and with the provision that the United Nations Security General is going to initiate research and reports on what is happening to this aid, how many civilians it's really reaching, and all of the circumstances of it. So the condition was that be done after 6 months, with the possible extension for another 6 months. So that would make a total of 1 year. But that is conditional on this report, which I think is a very good thing, because that report, if it's not whitewashed, if it's very authentic, that's going to be the proof, really. Now, they'll do everything they can to misreported or to prevent it from happening, but it's putting the onus on the UN Secretary General to find and report what's really going on. At the same time, both China and Russia have turned up the heat, and they have exposed something else that's very important that is also included in my article, which is all these crocodile tears for civilians in Idlib ignore the fact that there's 17 million Syrian civilians in the rest of Syria that are that are facing crushing U.S. sanctions right now, with a serious disruption of their economy, with real hunger starting to impact Syria, because they not only have Idlib, they've got the U.S. occupying northeast Syria, stealing the oil and stealing the wheat. And that is the wheat growing basket. That's the wheat basket of Syria. That's the prairies of Syria. So all of the, you know, it's hard not to be very cynical about hearing the U.S. crying about the humanitarian crossing while they're trying to strangle the vast majority of Syrian civilians.
Yeah, that was very striking in your article. And as we're speaking to Rick Sterling and weaponizing humanitarian aid. I mean, it's graphic the way you put it, because you mentioned that the Syrian Central Bank is outlawed by the U.S. and its allies. And of course, the sanctions, hardly a week goes by that they don't try to find some other way to strangle Syria. And apply just as you make this point. I mean, they're saying humanitarian aid, but actually all it is, they're permitting the terrorists an opportunity to thrive, almost prosper. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's sort of a dirty joke, and it's patently obvious from the way reading the article, there's no question of what's going on.
Yeah, it's really bad. And actually having a major impact in Lebanon, because the so-called Caesar Act in the U.S., which declared that the Syrian Central Bank was a quote-unquote money laundering institution, they put it in that category where they cannot be dealt with. That has totally disrupted trade with Lebanon. Now, I know there's many Lebanese Canadians, and they will know very well how much Lebanon has suffered, and particularly Lebanese banks, because Syria was the major export and import destination for Lebanon. So the brutal sanctions that the U.S. is imposing on Syria is also directly impacting and hurting Lebanon.
Yeah. You can see this is a good reminder of how all this policy is designed to control the Arab world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that they really, it's like we watched it all unfold with the talk about the so-called Arab Spring, which simply was political rhetoric from the West. But the whole goal was to break down all sovereignty in the region and make everyone subject to U.S. economic political hegemony. But Syria, they couldn't crack Syria. And that seems, it's almost like all pressure is there now. And literally with the players, Russia has been invited and are doing a good job of helping sustain a sovereign country. But then you have the uninvited Turkey, and you have the uninvited United States, and media here sees them as equivalent, which again speaks to the political backwardness of our culture. Yeah. It's not discussed that way.
It's not just the media, Phil. It's some leftist groups that treat the U.S. Presence in Syria the same as Russia, without distinguishing the total qualitative difference.
Yes, I'm afraid you're right. I mean, I think you'd have to call them the vanguard of the imperialists. they give aid, and some of them, of course, it's from the old Fourth International crowd around Obama, and the others are on new jobs in the State Department.
Right there. Yeah,
it's a terrible thing to watch. And this is Rick Sterling, by the way. Sterling has written many, pardon this pun, but Sterling pieces about the subject way back. But Rick, it is the power, the pressure. It's like watching great rocks weighing against you. You have Russian presence, you have American presence, and you have Turkey.
Yeah.
And they're really not, the Turkey is a questionable item there, because you have a government that is not quite sure who its friends are. I just wonder, you know, we have this issue just coming up, Cyprus. The United States is taking a position very hostile to Turkey on Cyprus.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have instability in Turkey from people who do not like all this collaborating with the West, with Turkish patriots, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see this playing out? Because the U.S. seems to be like they were in Afghanistan. They're there. They don't go away unless somebody steps on their foot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the $64,000 question, but one thing is clear. There's some reports that the U.S. May withdraw troops from Afghanistan. If they do, they won't have a way to support their troops in Syria. So I think they won't happen at the same time, but they may happen sequentially, which makes me think that the U.S. is very much going to resist withdrawing from Iraq, despite the fact that the Iraqi parliament voted for the expulsion of the U.S. troops a year ago.
Yeah.
But,
we're getting news on Sunday, the 25th. The Iraqi prime minister says he wants the American military to leave.
Yeah. Right.
This is, the ground is getting a little hot under the feet.
it is. Yeah.
And one wonders, you know, for all their commitment, obviously, to hegemony, it's a tough decision if you really want to. The question is, can you succeed with that? Sometimes it's smarter to back up a little bit.
The
mood in the region is definitely becoming extremely hostile to Western imperialism.
Yeah, well, as it should be. Look at the results from Afghanistan to Iraq to Syria to Libya. To Sudan even. What the U.S. has done is created chaos. And a nightmare for millions and millions of people.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask, make sure I mention this name, but you, in terms of how the U.S. Intelligence, creates difficulties or creates situations to which add to their propagandas in order to wage aggression against countries. You mentioned the International Refugee Committee. I hadn't been aware of their role there. And the name is David Miliband. Is that one of the old Miliband family?
I believe it is. I believe it is, with a UK very prominent political family in the UK.
There was
The International Rescue Committee is, their budget is $800 million a year. This is a major player. And they get a large majority of that is money that comes to them from governments. So it's almost like a government agency, even though, of course, it's called an NGO, a non-governmental agency. But when their budget is predominantly financed by the government and significantly by the U.S., they are a player in Syria, and they give material support, for example, to Idlib, and they're also very significant on the propaganda front, on the information front, because when there was all this publicity a month ago about the potential closing of that crossing, that border crossing at Bab al-Hawa, they were out there just screaming about how bad and how tragic it would be if Russia was to veto this at the UN Security Council. So they, like the White Helmets and other groups, they play a dual role. They are on the ground supporting The opposition, which in this case is led by Al-Qaeda, the official branch. And at the same time, they are very important in the information war. It's like Peter Ford said, the former UK ambassador to Syria, he's very insightful. He said that after the exposure of weapons of mass destruction and the lie that took place from the government, the West realizes they need other sources of information to persuade the population to disinform, misinform, and delude the population. And that's where the White Helmets, that's where, you know, the International Rescue Committee, it sounds like such a great group, but they are basically agents of the government.
Yes. You also do something that I always appreciate. I'm recalled over Upton Sinclair always wanted to emphasize who has the money and who's using it. David Miliband himself, I think you say he makes $1 million a year.
That guy is such a great humanitarian. He's he's donating his services. I haven't run the numbers. What does that work out to per hour? It's
it's a pretty good piece of the budget.
Well, they've got a budget of $800 million and just $1 million goes to David. So,
So anyway, I really appreciate that. I always think it's important to underline, well, who are these guys and who pays them?
Yeah. Yes.
Instead of assuming they're the nicest person on the block. When it comes to the International Refugee Committee, how do they get around this issue of running supplies through what is clearly an Al-Qaeda operation? How do they discuss those people?
Well, that's the whole point. It's the International Rescue Committee, along with a lot of other groups and agencies, are funded by the West, and they basically deal with contractors. So Doctors Without Borders, there are no people from Doctors Without Borders staff in Idlib, but they will have their agents or their, you know, contractors or their contacts. And the bad thing is that they're part of the propaganda front here. And, you know, somebody reporting from the Al-Qaeda zone, they're not a neutral observer. They're not an objective observer. They're promoting the Al-Qaeda story. And if they don't, they won't last long. Probably like, you know, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff, two American journalists who were sympathetic to the uprising in Syria, but they were honest enough in their reporting that they documented how the civilians in East Aleppo were really, you know, they were against the occupation, and how the opposition was quite unpopular, and look what happened to them.
Your article also, you point out, I think that the debate that the Security Council should get everybody's full attention, because as you alluded to a while ago, now there's going to be some criteria, and I notice it involves the Red Crescent and Red Cross. Mm-hmm. I know Western imperialism lost their enthusiasm for Red Cross. They wanted to supplant it, and my impression is they wanted to supplant it with nice sounding third parties. Mm-hmm. But if I understand this the way the Chinese and Russia are talking, they want this to be the Red Cross helping provide the facts,
right?
And and monitoring. That would be a big step forward. That would be also righting the ship, as it were.
I think so. And the big difference there as well is that they could do that and at the same time respect the UN Charter, which calls for territorial integrity of countries, because right now by authorizing this this border crossing from Turkey to the Al-Qaeda controlled region of Syria. And in effect, they're undermining the UN Charter. They are actively supporting this breakaway region, which, whether, you know, it's partly under Turkish shelter. Turkey might like to gobble that up at some point, but at the current time, it's basically controlled by this Al-Qaeda organization. It'd be as if British Columbia was controlled by Al-Qaeda, and supplies from the U.S. were flooding across the border into British Columbia. And Ottawa was questioning, why are you doing that? Why are you supporting this region of Canada that's dominated militarily by our enemies?
I think that's a very important point. Brother, we've been speaking to Rick Sterling, Covert Action Magazine, Weaponizing Humanitarian Aid. And Rick, I really like the fact that, I mean, you're raising this matter. This should be an issue for Canadian political parties. We're about to have an election soon. Mm-hmm. Somebody should answer for why would Canada be involved in humanitarian aid that is getting into the hands of terrorists, mm-hmm. And being directed to them? Mm-hmm. And your article gives them everything they need to know. It's just, we've been unsuccessful because of the power, I guess, the Western media propaganda, whatnot. Not taking up simple questions like the UN Charter, mm-hmm. the sovereignty mm-hmm. of countries.
Mm-hmm.
Putting it in front of people who actually claim to be, you know, want public office. How could you be supporting terrorists?
Yeah, right. I hope the question about Canadian foreign policy gets raised and discussed a lot, Phil. Canadian foreign policy is... Canada's a junior partner of the U.S.
Polite.
That deserves to be questioned and criticized in my mind.
Yeah.
The consequences for Syria have been really, really bad. Canada's played a pretty bad role there. So I hope it's people will talk about that and move toward a change.
Yeah. Well, your article is definitely going to help. Rick Sterling, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Look forward to talking more about this soon.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much, Phil.
Sure thing.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.